The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. I apologize for the delay in getting started. We had an audio glitch that I had to resolve, and I believe it is resolved. So again, my apologies. We will have a 90-minute program today, as usual. So for California time, we'll be through, if we stick to the regular time and don't go over, at about 5 minutes until 4 p.m. today, California time. Again, my apologies. So we do have a great show with someone who I've wanted to have on the Space Show as a guest for a long, long time. And I saw Mike again at the recent Starship Congress. And this time I got my act together and invited him and followed up. And I'm really happy that he is with us. But first, a couple of announcements. For those of you who would like to give us a call, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. So please remember that there are no call screeners, so be patient and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also email us today at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then also through the blog, and that is thespaceshow.com. And that is our website. So go all the way over to the far right to upcoming shows. And this will be the first show listed. Open that page up and then go to the bottom, which is where comments and questions are. And as soon as you post a comment or question, we will be able to bring it up on air. Note, you do not have to be logged into Discuss, which is our comment program for our blog. But sometimes mysteriously comments disappear if you don't log in, and that is an artifact of Discuss that has nothing to do with us. So if you are checking later on to make sure your comment went through and it's not there, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. I have now discovered where Discuss hides these comments, and I guess hides is a good way. We have no preferences to set or anything like that to control this random feature of Discuss, but I can restore your comments. So please do let me know if that does happen to you. And if you do go to thespaceshow.com, we have a newsletter that is posted, and check it out. And it has all the current activities for the week. And I got some announcements about this week because it's another crappy week for the Space Show because of my schedule. So I hope my final bit of dental surgery is tomorrow morning and the last one for this dog attack accident I had in March of 2016. Yes, I'm still dealing with that. So I will be unable to talk and do the show tomorrow. And there's no Hotel Mars because I have jury duty scheduled for the rest of the week, and actually possibly into next Monday as well. I am making an effort to be excused due to probable dental pain, and my foot is in this crazy boot still from the dog attack, and it's hard to walk. So we'll see if I am serving or not, and I'll keep you posted. But I've blocked the week starting Wednesday for jury duty. So it's going to be a short week for the Space Show. And then on Sunday, we will be back live with Open Lines. And Monday is an unknown quantity because of possible jury duty spillover. But I am planning a full week starting on Tuesday of next week. And if I can resume full scheduling because of not having to do the full time on jury duty, I will see about building in some shows. So here's where all of you can be helpful. If you have people you would love to hear on the Space Show that seriously can be available at a moment's notice to fill in at the last minute, either on something like this, I find out I'm excused from jury duty, or I don't have to give up as many days as I think I have to give up, or a guest gets sick and cancels out at the last minute, please send me their name and contact information, because I'm short of having last-minute emergency fill-in guests and would love to have a supply of them, an inventory of them. It's kind of hard to talk about having people as inventory, but if you know some people like that and some topics, bring them forward, okay, because I'm real interested in that. So everything we do on our website is archived, so do check that out. You can download shows real quickly. You can upload them, and you can listen right off of our website. So that's pretty cool. And there is a store, if you're interested in Space Show logo wear, and that is in the upper left menu under support. And then pay attention to the Listen Live button in that upper left menu, because remember, we now give you all the instructions for listening live, listening to an archive show, a podcast show. And for those of you that are tuning in with TuneIn and Alexa, we have an Alexa-embedded TuneIn player, and you can listen to all of our podcast through Alexa if you're doing that. And I'm really appreciative. One person did write and tell me why they use Alexa, and it does sound really, really cool if you get your systems to work with it and you're using it. I totally get it. I don't think it's for me, but hey, I understand it, and I am really glad that we're able to provide the Alexa service on the Space Show. So a couple of other things. We do have the important button of Support the Space Show. So remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we bring you these shows because we have support from all of you to do so. And we thank you very much for that support as a 501c3 nonprofit. If you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're lucky enough to pay California taxes, you get a tax deduction here too. And here we're called a public benefit corporation. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check out their webpage for more information, or simply email me at drspace@thisspaceshow.com. We do have corporate sponsors, and their banners are going across our website. And hey, congratulations to one of our corporate sponsors, Orbital ATK. Boy, they've got a great merger going with Northrop, and we'll probably hear more about that, and that's supposed to take place sometime early next year. For those of you that had Orbital ATK stock, lucky you, and that's probably going to be a pretty cool merger for the industry from everything that I'm reading about it. But do check out our banner ads. Now, normally I would read a quick message from our sponsors, but I'm going to pass that up, even though we're doing a full 90-minute show because of the delays. In my long announcement about the delays and my absences this week, I'm just going to thank our sponsors, which are the New World Conference, and they are coming up in Austin, Texas, November 10th through the 11th. Their website for more detail is newworlds2017.space. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor, and that's with thespaceplan.com. Very cool. You can buy the full-size poster. Check it out. The Space Foundation, a great sponsor, and their 34th symposium is just around the corner, April 16th through the 19th. Their website for that is spacesymposium.org. And you'll hear more about that as well. And then, as I said, Orbital ATK is a sponsor, and congratulations on your merger. AIAA, another great sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. And then, of course, Celestis, which is the pioneer and only proven provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services. Check them out at Celestis.com. So we appreciate all of our sponsors, and thank you for being with us. So our guest today, who I mentioned a few minutes ago, is Mike Wall. And Dr. Mike Wall has been a writer at Space.com for 7 years, since 2010. And this is interesting. You'll love this. Before becoming a journalist, He worked as a herpetologist and wildlife biologist. He has his PhD in evolutionary biology from the University of Sydney, Australia. He has a bachelor's degree from the University of Arizona. Go Wildcats, that's where I went to school. And a graduate certificate in science writing from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Mike, and I apologize deeply for the delay in starting our show today. How are you?
Good, I'm good, yeah. Good to be on.
So,
thanks for having me.
I cannot resist. What work did you do as a herpetologist?
Oh, I did a lot of stuff. I mean, like, I mostly studied snakes. Coming from Arizona, that's where I grew up, there are a lot of rattlesnakes there. And so I actually studied rattlesnakes a lot. And then, like, I went to Australia to actually do grad school just to work with, there was a guy there who was a real snake expert. So I wanted to work with him. And, of course, there are a lot of very venomous snakes in Australia. I didn't really go around grabbing them. But, that was part of the reason I went, was just to travel and experience new things and see a lot of the cool animals that they've got over there. I've come to space journalism by a very different route than I think most people have.
Did you grab rattlesnakes and handle them?
No. Well, I would grab them using tongs. I'm not one of those people who pin them behind the head and try to look really cool and macho and everything. That's just very dangerous and very stupid. But I would have to catch them to do research on them. So you'd use tongs and you'd put them into a big bag, basically like a really long pillowcase, and you tie it up and be extremely careful the entire time, obviously, because they can strike very, very fast. They're ambush predators, so... That's how they make a living, is like super fast strikes. And just be very, very careful with them. And I'm like still alive and I've played on my fingers, so I must have done something right.
So when I was a young kid and before they outlawed rattlesnake hunts, I went on the Oklahoma rattlesnake roundup. And, of course, my brother and I and a couple of friends, we actually hired a guide to go with us. We weren't dumb enough to go hiking in the rocks looking for rattlers on our own because we didn't have any experience with them. But we wore big boots, and we had huge gloves on and long sleeve stuff and denim pants, not that that would make any difference. And the snake handler had a 6-foot snake stick with trigger thongs on it, a fork on it that you could grab it. And he would grab it, and he had these huge, big burlap bags, and he would drop the damn thing tail first into the burlap bag and then immediately start twirling the bag and winding it up, and then he'd close the top of it, so the snake was in there. And then you'd throw your snakes into the pen in downtown O'Keene that they had created, and they'd have prizes for the biggest ones and all that, but they had exhibitions on what these snakes would do. So they had these fools who probably have been bitten a million times and are immune to it by now go into the pit with, hundreds of rattlers, and they'd have a couple of balloons, and they would hold a balloon out in front of a rattlesnake, and you could not see the snake move and pop the balloon there so quick. I mean, they're fast. We could not see the snake move. We could see the balloon pop, but we never saw the snake move. And, they're so ugly and mean and scary looking, I don't know how you'd even want to handle them or be around them.
I just think they're really cool. I think they're really thing in, like, a lot of different ways. I don't know. I can't really explain why. Probably just being a kid and going out into the desert hiking and seeing them and just, wow, I'm seeing them up close, and, it's just... Just one of those things that kind of sparked a lifelong fascination with them. I'm still really into. I mean, if I go on a hike, I'm always flipping over boards and like looking for snakes now. I mean, I don't catch them anymore, but I still like finding them and taking pictures and stuff. So I just think they're really cool animals.
I'm always observant when I'm hiking and walking with my dog. We do have Pacific Coast rattlers in my area. They don't really come into where I live, but you never know. But I do have them, and all the vets have anti-venom, and because, dogs do get bitten every once in a while by them. And, of course, we grew up with copperheads and water moccasins in Oklahoma. And so they do snakes do fascinate me, as do alligators and crocodiles. And I know Australia has that nasty little, is it a Taipei or something like that, that's really deadly?
Yeah, they've got a fair chunk of like the most venomous snakes in the world. I mean, by various measures, like, I don't know, 7 out of the 10 most venomous snakes in the world are Australian or something along those lines. They're all cobra relatives, basically. They don't have any vipers over there. Like
no the rattlers.
Rattlesnake relatives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's an advantage for going to Mars. There's probably no deadly snakes on Mars, right?
No, but there is a lot of other stuff that I'm going on Mars. Cold and youth radiation and lack of atmosphere, all that stuff.
Nothing compared to coming up head to head with a 6-foot rattlesnake that can get you before you know about it.
Yeah.
Or get your dog or something. But I'm still fascinated with them and alligators, as I said, and crocodiles. All reptiles really do fascinate me. I've eaten a lot of them, and they're not bad tasting, but getting the image out of your head ruins the meal. So I can't recommend it. When you go to alligator farms in Florida, they serve you alligator steak and stuff like that. And I've tried it, and the same with rattlesnake. And as I said, I've tried it. Everyone says this stuff tastes like chicken, but the mental image is certainly not that of a chicken. On to space.
Yeah.
What's your favorite kind of space story that you like to report on?
There's probably a couple. Probably what gets me most excited is the search for alien life, and that's really heating up. So I really like exoplanet stories, and especially, Kepler discoveries about potentially habitable worlds. And I'm really excited by stories where, whether or not Mars could have hosted life. It seems pretty clear now that in the ancient past it could have, and it might possibly still support life. And with the Cassini mission, all that it did, in the 13 years of Saturn, finding multiple possibly habitable worlds in the Saturn system, it's just so cool that all of these moons in the outer solar system have subsurface oceans, and that's something that we didn't realize until just a few years ago. That's what I get most excited about, I think. And it's just really interesting too, because it's sort of turning in, it's definitely kind of segued from a fringe pursuit to like real hard science, astrobiology, and even SETI to like maybe a lesser degree, just because we don't have as much data on the intelligent life aspect, obviously. Both of them are becoming real mainstream disciplines, and it's like once like kind of now that we know how much potentially habitable real estate there is out there, billions and billions of planets in our own galaxy just by itself. It's pretty exciting to kind of write about that, and it's like we're only going to get more and more of those stories as we go ahead. And then eventually, I think at some point we're going to write the story about we have found alien life. I think, I don't know if it's going to be in 10 years or 20 years, but I think that'll probably happen at some point in the relatively near future.
At Starship Congress, there were a lot of talks that kind of focused on different aspects of interstellar flight for humans, not just for micro wafers or something like that.
Right.
You don't see a whole lot of stories in space news about interstellar anything that's very serious. But is that a big topic of interest, and why don't we see more credible stories about it? There certainly are a lot of people that could be interviewed and that are working on different kinds of interstellar related projects. I interview a lot of them that could that could talk about different things, even advanced propulsion more so than nuclear, like M-drive and stuff. You just don't see a whole lot of it.
That's a good question, and that's something I think it's really interesting too. I think part of it is maybe just because it's still such early days, and the technology is still like so far away from being feasible. And we have ideas about what the best sort of like propulsion system might be, but even that's kind of being debated now about what is the technology that's going to take roads between the stars. And Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it is probably just because we're just starting out, and so it's hard to really know what's real and what's hype. That kind of changed last year, I think. I mean, Breakthrough Starshot has come out, and they're like a real player with real money behind them, and like a lot of big names. They're the ones, obviously, who want to like send tiny spacecraft probes to like nearby star systems, Alpha Centauri in particular, with like powerful laser blasts that could send them there at like 20% the speed of light. And they're hoping to get the first launch in like 20, 25 years, something like that. And so that may represent kind of like an inflection point, kind of a change where it's a lot of kind of people working kind of on their own in like isolated labs. They don't have much funding, and they're hoping to find make a breakthrough and make something feasible into like more of a sustained long-term like research project with a lot of money behind it. They've got about $100 million to do this, and that's really rare in this advanced propulsion sort of community, you know. So that may shift things into, we might start seeing more serious stories coming out, and maybe that'll shift this topic more into the sort of mainstream. It's like, wow, this could actually happen in our lifetime.
When you're writing articles and doing things with space.com or other sources, is there a type of story or a focus of a story that the editors seem to have a preference for and want people to cover or to, point out or to support? Is there something like a directive that comes from editors?
No, it's sort of, it's kind of hard to explain. There are some stories that it's just obvious that we're going to cover, right? And it's obvious it's going to be like a big push. I mean, Cassini's final days, that was just obvious, right? That was a big mission, and we knew we wanted to commemorate the mission and like cover the like last week or so, and then the final plunge. We knew we wanted to cover that all out. But anytime there's a SpaceX launch or a big satellite launch or like obviously any kind of like scientific mission launch, then we know we're going to cover that. And if there's a paper in like a major journal like Science or Nature or something like that that's interesting, then we know we're going to cover that. But for the most part, it's the various writers and just kind of looking around and seeing what they find and what's interesting to them, to all of us. And then we have a meeting every Monday to kind of map out the week, and we talk to each other over the course of every day to kind of see what we all want to write about and what we find interesting. And it just kind of happens. It just develops every day because every day is different. Like you don't know what, like you wake up in the morning and you don't know what you're going to be covering mostly. I mean, unless you're working on one of these kind of bigger projects like we did with the solar eclipse, which was another one that we obviously knew we were going to write like 100 stories about. And you just wake up and you poke around and you see what you want to write about, and then you like talk to each other and kind of map out a strategy for the day, and that morphs into a strategy for the week and just keeps rolling along.
How do you see the broader, bigger picture space community evolving and changing? So years ago when I first met you at a Space Frontier Foundation meeting when they were still able to do them at NASA Ames because Pete Warden was the director and he said that was okay,
mm-hmm.
The industry is really different. So how have you seen it change, and is it easier to cover? Are there more interesting stories out there to write about, or companies to write about, or individuals? What's happening from a journalistic perspective?
Yeah, I think it's getting more exciting and also more difficult to cover, just because like you're saying, there are more players involved now. There's more going on, and that's a great thing, right? I mean, with the whole CubeSat revolution that we're in the middle of, it's getting really, I mean, like you used to have to be like a national government or like a space agency or a defense department or a really kind of deep pocketed like communications company to be able to launch a satellite, and that's not true anymore. I mean, you see students in like high school being able to put a payload onto a rocket on a rideshare basis now, and that's a great thing for space and for the world, because that means we're going to I get a lot more cool stuff up in space and do a lot more research and make the world care a lot more about space science and research and exploration. So that's all great. But, yeah, I mean, it does make it harder to cover because there's a lot more going on, and you have to sift through a lot more stuff. And, like, I mean, you have to kind of prioritize what you really want to write about because there's no way you can write about all of it, which is like, a great problem to have, right? I mean, it's great that there's so much activity now. And it's not just NASA, and NASA's still doing great stuff, but there's a lot of other things going on now, too.
You have your first email question of the day from Bob, who's listening to us in Denver, and he said, glad you started the show, David. I was about to give up. So, Mike, it's good to hear you talking. Here is my question. I share the excitement and the new people coming into the industry and the opportunities and all of what we're learning and hearing about, both through space news as well as conferences. But I'm not so sure that this is being dispersed or spread throughout the general community. I don't know how many people in the general community are getting enthused and inspired by what's going on in the space community. I'm wondering if you have any feel, Mike, for how space is playing in just the regular everyday community. Is it translating some of that energy into a general audience, or is it still just a very specialized segment of the market and of the audience that cares about space and can connect the dots to space and values for us all?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's something we all think about all the time. And it's kind of, there are a couple different sides to that, both pro and con. I mean, I think it's harder to sort of reach anybody, like, about anything now, and easier at the same time. I mean, harder because there's so many conflicting kind of, or so many competing information sources and so many ways to distract yourself and take up your time, like, online, you know, Facebook, Twitter, video games, Instagram, all this stuff. There's so much competing for people's attention that it's harder to get through there. At the same time, it's also like you have all these avenues that you can use to try to do it. So I think it may be kind of harder to hold people's attention and convince them something is cool, but maybe easier to try to kind of make the initial foray. And I don't know if we're – it's an interesting question about where space stands in the public consciousness now. I mean, I think it's obviously nowhere near where it was in, like the Apollo era, when, yeah, it galvanized, well, I mean, because of the sort of space race and putting people on the moon, and that was an amazing, deeply dramatic kind of chain of events that captured a whole country and kind of the whole world. And I don't know if we're going to see that anytime soon unless we send people to Mars or something like that. But at the same time, kind of like I talked about at the beginning, there is some really exciting stuff going on that I think people are picking up on in the public, and that's like the whole exoplanet revolution that we're in the middle of. And people are realizing that there are so many worlds out there. I mean, every star has an average more than one planet. So like every star that you see in the sky, you know, you like on a dark night, you can look up and imagine every single star you see, you have a couple of worlds at least like swirling around it. That's amazing. And I think that's trickling down a little bit. And people are starting to internalize this prospect that there is a real chance that there's life out there and that we might be able to actually find it. And so that, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever see NASA get 4.5% of the federal budget ever again. And it's kind of hovered around 0.5%, 0.4% for the last decade. So it's not translating into any kind of like funding success if there is an interest. It's going up. But, I mean, I think people are paying attention to the exoplanet, the alien life search stuff, and that has the potential to make big inroads, as does what SpaceX is doing, what Blue Origin is doing, some of the stuff on the private side where we're landing rockets. And that's an awesome kind of, like, dramatic thing that you see on video, and that goes viral and captures people's attention. And if SpaceX launches people around the moon, two people around the moon in a couple of years like they want to do, that could be a really galvanizing factor. That could do something toward getting people like really into space again. again, and if we do see moon colonies from the private sector, like some people like Robert Bigelow want to do, then yeah, then we're going to see a real ramp up of interest, and we'll just have to wait and see on that side of things.
Sally is in Tacoma with a note, and she says, those of us in the space community or space advocates know very well the name of the people, the name of the company, and the players that are involved. I'm wondering if you have any way to judge how well known something like Bigelow or Blue Origin or some of these leading people, other than Elon Musk, who I think is an exception because he commands so much publicity. But how well are these household names known to the general public, and do they relate them to space, or is Bezos, for example, only related to Amazon? Is there any way for you to have your hands into this and have a take on it with your journalistic work?
Yeah, I mean, I think Elon Musk is obviously the most prominent sort of private player. Like almost everybody knows who he is, and it's not just because of SpaceX, obviously. It's because he's involved in Tesla and SolarCity, and he's sort of like, he's very prominent in lots of different fields. Bezos, I don't know if a lot of people even really know that he's behind Blue Origin. I mean, like when they started, they were very low profile, and they're kind of starting to become higher profile when they did their five kind of like suborbital landings and launches and like an orbital landing. They kind of came out of the dark, and they broadcast videos of it and all the rest. So they're becoming more kind of out in the open, and I think that'll raise their profile, obviously. But I think most people probably don't know necessarily that Bezos is actually behind Blue Origin or what their plans are. And as far as like what I can do or what we in the media can do, I don't know. I mean, that's to maintain like kind of legitimacy as a journalist. You need to be. You can't be like a cheerleader, even though like we all feel that way. We all want space to succeed and amazing things to happen, but you can't just sort of take it as your role to kind of pump things up and say how great it is, and you just report on what you see, and you just hope that it's cool enough on its own that people will see that, and that if you get it out there, then it can stand on its own two legs. You know, that's what we're supposed to do. We do have, we've got an op-ed section at space.com, and there are a lot of people who do have editorial sections, and so we invite scientists and engineers and space flight, like kind of, people who are in the space flight industry to write what they want to write about their latest research or about what their companies are doing, and it's clearly labeled that it's an op-ed. And so that's something that we've done, that we've instituted recently, to kind of let people get their like word out, people in the space community. You can't really do any overt cheerleading if you're a journalist and want to continue to be taken seriously, I guess.
Do you ever write an op-ed in space.com? Do you ever do that, or do you go for straight journalism only?
No, that section, it's just restricted to people like scientists and engineers and space flight kind of people, like people who are behind space flight companies and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's not really for us as the writer.
Not for the in-house
crew. But by doing
crew.
Stuff like this, I mean, going on the space show and talking to people, and all that plays a role toward getting the message out, whatever that message might be to different people. I think it's just, there's a lot of cool stuff going on in space, and we need to be more interested in it and get the public's awareness up and get Congress's awareness up, the president's awareness up, so that translates into bigger budgets down the road and bigger achievements like down the road, both in science and exploration.
You have a caller on the line. Hello, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling us.
Hey, David. I'm just calling you from Washington State.
Okay, you don't have a great phone line, but let's go for it.
Okay, I was just calling to find out, as you heard in the updates on space.
Okay, say it again. You're fading out, so say it again. Updates on what, please? Mike, do you know what he's trying to say? Because we keep losing him.
No, I kept breaking up. I couldn't hear.
I'll try to call you back.
Okay.
Thanks.
That's the problem with bad phone lines. They don't work. So probably going through space. That's why they probably don't work. what can I say? What do you think has been the biggest space story of 2017? And do you think it'll be scooped by something that happens in October, November, or December?
Kind of based on like how much interest it got on our website, the biggest by far was the solar eclipse. I couldn't believe. I mean, I knew it would be big. I didn't know that the public would care as much as they did. I mean, I thought it was great that they cared as much as they did, but I was kind of taken aback by how it became this like national phenomenon, and it made it into very mainstream. I mean, you had all these stories in Washington Post and New York Times and people going on like Good Morning America to talk about the eclipse and all that. I mean, that's been the biggest story just based on the reader interest and kind of national interest. And I don't think that'll be beaten before the end of the year. It was a huge, huge event. And it really captured the entire country.
We're going to come back to that. We have our caller back. Let's hope we have a better phone line. Hi, caller. Welcome back. Can you give us your name one more time, please?
Yeah, this is John Thompson calling from Washington State.
Okay, go ahead. John, right?
Right.
Okay.
We're out here in the Washington State area. It's kind of, we've just been over a big fire scare here. I was just calling to find out if you've heard any updates about the Bigelow Aerospace and what they're up to lately.
Did you get that, Mike?
It's some kind of company.
He wants to know if you have heard any updates about Bigelow Aerospace and what they may be up to at this point in time.
Oh, okay. Not any super recent updates. I mean, I know that they've got their kind of prototype space habitat has been attached to the International Space Station for a while now, and they're testing it out to see how it performs in space, and it's apparently been doing really well. That's a good sign for them, because they want to do private space stations in orbit and maybe around the moon, and Robert Bigelow has said that he wants to start up, colonies on the moon. I don't know if colonies is too grand a word, but I mean outposts where people can go to the moon and pay a fair bit of money and stay in kind of like a lunar hotel. He's dead serious about that and doing in space tests. They've now tested three of their habitats in space. They had two free flyers that they tested, Genesis 1 and 2. That was a few years back that just orbited Earth. And so they're serious. They've done three in space tests, and I think that their expandable habitats have performed very well. And so we'll just see. They've contracted with Boeing, I think, to work together on their private space stations and the transport to them. So, yeah, keep an eye out. Maybe in the next three to 5 years, you'll see something big happening there.
Do you have any other questions, John?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Speaking of Bigelow, I mean, they do have some competition. I hope I'm not using the word lightly, but that would be with Axiom, who wants to build commercial private space stations, and they have a terrific, talented team. In fact, some of their team was at the Space Foundation's financial thing that they had a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco. Amir was there and a couple of other people. I don't think they're pursuing exactly the same market. Do you see them as head-to-head competitors, or are there actually different market sectors starting to appear for private or commercial space stations?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it's maybe a little too early to say how the market's going to kind of shake out. Maybe there'll be different, because will one of them go after more kind of like space research, government space agencies, and like and universities to do research on like how, yeah, like I don't know, yeah, drug development goes in microgravity, or how, yeah, how antibiotics behave in microgravity, that sort of thing. And like I know Axiom is very interested in the research side of things. And yeah, I mean, you're right. They're very legit. I mean, like one of their major people was the former ISS NASA program manager. Mike Stefanini. And yeah, so I think, and Bigelow from, he would certainly welcome that same sort of commercial market, you know, science and research and things like that. But he's also been very open about the tourism side of things and wanting to kind of market to people who want a space adventure and space tourism sort of thing. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if the market's going to segregate along two clear lines like that. Like you go to the Bigelow station if you want to have a 2-week jaunt, and you go to the Axiom station if you're a pharmaceutical company who wants to do drug development work and zero G. I don't know. I think it's too early to say how that's going to shake out.
You have a by the way, listeners, our phone number is available if you would like to use it, 1-866-687-7223. So Jack is in Tucson, and Jack has a question and says, I'm wondering if you're seeing a big difference in private companies, entrepreneurial companies, and success, and how is success finally being measured in the new space, the commercial space world? We know how it's measured with a Boeing or a Lockheed. We can see their stock prices and whether they're going up or down, or their contracts that get published in the paper all the time. But how can we determine success with a lot of these new space and emerging companies when they're privately held and we don't know very much about them, and we don't see contracts being given to them for this or that in the space news press all the time? So my ultimate question to you is, how do we know if the new space or this emerging commercial space industry is really succeeding or not?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And first of all, I mean, hope he's doing good in Tucson. I used to live in Tucson for a number of years, and I just really like that city. So, I hope he's having a good time down there. But it's too early to tell. There are some of these startups that have already done, like, really amazing things and have put a lot of hardware into space. I mean, Planet is probably the most, the most prominent of those. It's a San Francisco-based company that has already launched more than 100 Earth-observing satellites. They're CubeSats. They're very small. They can image the Earth with very high precision, very good accuracy. And they've already launched a lot of those CubeSats into space, and they're already gathering a lot of imagery for a bunch of different customers. So there are some that are like that, but they're kind of an outlier in terms of how fast they've worked and how quickly they've gotten that big constellation up. With most of them, especially the ones that are very ambitious, we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, if you look at a company like, what's it take? I mean, Moon Express, for example, they're trying to win the Google Lunar X Prize, right? So in the next few months, we'll see if they're able to, 5 to 6 months is it the deadline, in March of next year. We'll see if they're able to get their private lander to the moon and get it to do what they need to do to actually win that jackpot. And then after that is where they really like want to do their business. And that's going to be a shakedown cruise to show they can do it. And then we'll see if they can convince like space agencies or university research organizations if they can convince those groups to put a payload on the lander. And, so these are like multi-year sort of processes. You know, you have to prove that it works, and then you have to convince people after that proof that it's going to keep working. And there's really no way to know. I mean, you can't really tell which of these companies. I just picked Moon Express as an example because they're like, we're going to find out soon enough if they make the deadline. I'm not trying to hold them up as the best or the most prominent, but it's just an example that we're going to see. Yeah, so there are a lot of companies like that where you just have to wait and see what they do. And that might take 2 years, it might take 3 years, and it's going to be really hard to tell because a lot of these companies are obviously privately held and we're not seeing their finances and we don't know how much money they're raising behind the scenes. And so yeah, we'll just have to wait and just kind of follow their progress. And I think it's safe to say that a lot of these companies won't make it. But I don't think you can really sit down and say and kind of pick which ones are going to succeed and which ones are not. You're just going to have to wait and see.
You mentioned Planet a few minutes ago, so you're probably aware of it because you're a very well-read guy and you're in the news business, but maybe many listeners are not. But Planet, a couple of weeks ago, repositioned some of their little CubeSat Earth imaging satellites, and they imaged the North Korean nuclear test site, and they showed the picture that the test site was actually caving in and suffering damage from their test. And those pictures were printed all over the world in all sorts of media, and the company Planet was given credit for having their satellites to do it. And I thought that's pretty cool because none of the big imaging companies that we always hear about, you know, the big famous ones or the French ones or any of them, they didn't do it.
Yeah.
And here comes Planet with a bunch of little CubeSats and did it.
That's the power of a big constellation, right? Because they've got so many eyes looking down and they're conceivably looking at lots of different things and lots of different parts of the Earth and lots of different spectra. Yeah, that sort of thing is really powerful. And as we go forward the next 5, 10, 20 years, you're going to be going to see more and more, you know, it won't all be from Planet, but more and more instruments like that getting up there, and you're going to see it's just going to be a snowball effect in terms of what people can do from orbit. Measuring like crop yields from space, trying to kind of interdict poaching operations of wildlife. I mean, there are all these applications that we can kind of get that, but we'll be surprised at what these things can do as more and more of them get up there.
For people who think little CubeSat arrays don't do much, quite the contrary, and they do a lot, and they can be really powerful. I don't think it was a CubeSat array that did it, but the Canadian company that played a role with their satellites in saving those women from trafficking last year. I'm sure you know the story, and I can't remember the name of the company in Canada, but it's very well known.
Yeah,
and they cooperated with the different police around the world to do this, and they positioned their satellites, and they found the container and the bad guys and the women in the container via their satellites, and directed the people to come in and arrest the bad guys and rescue them. And when the funny thing was, when they told them that they were saved because they could see them from space and from the sky, the people were so ignorant and poor that were being sold into this sex slave trade stuff that they didn't have any idea what they were talking about. I mean, it was just beyond them to think that happened from space.
That's a great story, and it shows you how powerful these instruments are. Yeah, they can, and cameras are only going to get better, and they're only going to get sharper, and what people are going to be able to do is only going to, it's just going to improve. So yeah, it's really exciting.
Well, I guess if someone wants to fork over $1,000 for an iPhone X, they'll have a pretty powerful camera. I guess that's supposed to be one of their major benefits, right? Your take on space tourism. I don't know how much you follow the industry, but from my perspective, it almost seems like space tourism, which was really a reason why I started the space show, is being passed by so many other developments in entrepreneurial space and new rocket technology, not necessarily for humans. Space tourism seems to be really lagging and not getting the attention. So how do you see it from a journalistic perspective?
Yeah, there are still a few major players who are developing. I mean, the Virgin Galactic, obviously, Blue Origin, obviously, and, WorldView, which is developing a you know, like a balloon system to take people up. They don't get to space, but they go to near space, and you'll be able to, you'll ride a balloon and be able to see the curvature of the Earth and the blackness of space. And they're all dead serious, and they're all making progress. They're all doing test flights. And so I don't think that the kind of drop-off in the coverage is indicative of a lack of progress in that subset of the space industry. I think maybe it's just sort of gotten swamped by a bunch of other developments, kind of, that have gotten more press. Just what SpaceX is doing with its orbital rocket, and then the plans that, like, how they want to go to Mars, and you're seeing all this stuff, and Blue Origin's work on the, you know, like on the New Glenn orbital rocket. Like, I think that people have short attention spans, and so when there's one shiny object, they can only concentrate on it for so long, and there are other shiny objects, and then they get talked about more and kind of rise to the fore. But yeah, I mean, Virgin Galactic is still going along, and I'm Blue Origin is dead serious, and they've proven that they can launch the same rocket and the same capsule to suborbital space and actually bring them both down safely 5 times in relatively short order. And that's the basic kind of architecture for their suborbital tourism kind of system. So yeah, I mean, I think that stuff is not too far away. I mean, it's another question as to will that market persist and will it be able to support more than one player based on the kind of prices and how many people will be able to pay the prices for a ticket, or will the market get saturated quickly? That's a whole other question. But I mean, I think that there's still stuff happening. But we just get a little, I mean, other newer things come along, and we just get a little distracted, I think.
Bob, and Bob is in Los Angeles, and Bob says, I'm interested in journalism and space, so I'm wondering if one has to be a journalist from a journalism school or department to be a space journalist. I noticed that your background did not really include journalism, so what is the key path in order to be a journalist and to be hired by a reputable organization? I know there's a lot of blogs and other alternatives for writing, but they don't carry the same weight or have the same prestige as, say, space.com. Do you need to go to journalism school? Do you need to be an aerospace engineer or just have a big interest in space and know a lot about it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can only speak to my own experience and what I've kind of seen other people do, like, around me. And yeah, I didn't, like, go to, yeah, I didn't do journalism in sort of undergrad. I didn't do a master's program in it, but I did do, you know, 1 year, kind of journalism kind of graduate certificate at the University of California, Santa Cruz. So got a little bit of grounding, or like a year's worth of grounding, and then you kind of make connections and you write and you do internships, and through that program there are a few like it. So I would say, just based on how my life has kind of shaped up, I mean, if you're really serious about it, then you might want to look at like one of those, like either NYU has like a really high profile kind of like journalism master's program. I mean, UC Santa Cruz has a very high profile 1 year writing certificate thing, graduate certificate thing, which is what I did. And it's just hard to get your foot in the door. So those are ways to do it. There's a lot of people who have blogs and are really good writers and are really, really smart. But getting your foot in the door can be hard. I mean, it doesn't matter how competent you are. Yeah, it obviously matters your intelligence and your competence, but sometimes like doing a program like that to make the connections and get your foot in the door is like what you need. And so I guess if you're really serious about it, then I guess that would be like one piece of advice that I could give you. And then at the same time, I would caveat it by, it's not to say that's the only way that you could ever do it. But that's sort of what has worked for me and for other people who I know.
So at least get some kind of academic experience in writing and journalism and internships and things like that to help you get your foot in the door.
And you can sometimes pitch people, even if you don't have like a formal background in journalism, if you like if you pitch some of these organizations, media organizations, and you can say sometimes that you'd be willing to do an internship for them, or I mean, sometimes you could like present freelance work, and you can ask if they accept freelance pitches, and just see if you can get your foot in the door that way. But yeah, I mean, like doing an internship somewhere, even if it's not paid, if you can wrangle that would be a great way, just because you need to find a way for people to get to know you and to know your work and to get work out there that people can look at and say, oh, this person is good. Like, I would consider accepting freelance stories from this person, or I consider hiring this person. And unless you do something like an internship, or if you have a connection somewhere, then it's kind of hard to actually make that first contact.
This is from Wanda in Chicago. And Wanda says, I'm a frequent listener to the show, but I hardly ever email in, and I never call in for a variety of reasons. But lots of shows with lots of people talking about the high likelihood of finding either past life indications at Mars or someplace else in the solar system, or extraterrestrial life, or even intelligent life. A lot of people think that we're actually going to find that someday. Mike, from your vantage point, if intelligent life were found, or even current life were found, let's forget past life, do you think it would be shocking to many segments of our global population, or would everybody embrace it and be happy and excited? Or would it cause a cultural upheaval? How do you see the absolute bona fide confirmation of the existence of extraterrestrial life, especially if it happens to be intelligent?
Yeah, that is a really, really good question. And I don't think anybody really knows. I mean, I think there are a lot of factors that will affect what kind of impact that it actually has. I mean, I think if it's microbial life, and it's extinct, like say we sent, like say we get samples back from Mars, we're going to launch, yeah, NASA's going to like launch a sample caching rover to Mars in 2020. And actually NASA wants to get some of those samples back to Earth and sort through them and look for signs of life. Say that those samples come back to Earth in like 2025 or 2027 or that kind of rough time frame, and they find microfossils, or they find some other like definitive proof that there was life on Mars 3.5 billion years ago, whatever. I think that would be a really exciting discovery, and I think people would hail it and be really excited about it. But I don't think that it would cause a big outcry. I don't think it would shake the foundations of our religious beliefs or anything like that, just because I think that we're kind of primed for that, like kind of already. We're kind of primed for that discovery already, based on what we know about Mars and its past, and like a lot of that from what Curiosity's done in its 5 years on Mars, telling us that there was a habitable environment on Mars in the ancient past for like millions of years at a time, and we know there were lakes, we know there were streams, there was probably an ocean. So I think that thought is already out there in the general public's mind. I think if it were currently alive, if we saw like living, squirming microbes, that would be a bigger deal. And obviously it would be like, well, we have to go back and figure out where they live and what they do. And then that would generate debate about, well, should we go back? Because we could introduce Earth microbes and it could swamp the native ecosystem, and what's our responsibility? So I think that would have a bigger impact, and it would be more exciting still. And then if we find intelligent life, then that's the one that will be, that would have the most impact, I think. But at the same time, that the impact would be, I don't know how long it would last, because it's sort of a paradox, because if we get a steady signal and everybody agrees that it is a sign of an intelligent civilization, and that's going to be world-changing, because we will know that we are not the only intelligent species. I mean, we're not the only intelligent species on Earth. There are a lot of smart animals here, but we're not the only technological civilization in the universe, in the galaxy. And in fact, we're probably nowhere near as advanced as this other civilization that we detect. Just based on our development, we're only 100 years into the sort of radio age, and the chances are anybody else who is out there is far more advanced than we are, just based on how old the universe is, and it's almost 14 billion years old. So the chances are that, like, whoever we contact is going to be way more advanced than we are. And that's going to cause a lot of sort of consternation. I think that'll affect religion a little bit more, because then you'll have to, there'll be people who will take it in stride, you know, and say, oh, this is fine. God accounts for this is fine, and kind of mold it into their own theology. But there'll be some people who very much resist that and say it's not in the Bible, so it's not true. There's no explicit mention of the alien world, so it's not true. And then there'll be others who are afraid. What are these beings going to, what could they do to us? What do they want? Do we need to be afraid? I mean, that's sort of a legitimate question that people ask. If they're that much more advanced, then, I mean, if they wanted to destroy us, they probably could pretty easily. But the paradox that I talked about kind of comes in is that there will be this initial flurry of debate and, like, what does it mean and who are we as a species and where does humanity fit into the universe? But the chances are the signal is going to be coming from, like, a really long way away, right? So, like, 20,000 light years away, maybe? Or
maybe, yeah,
even
a long
if it's
way.
Like 500 light years away. Yeah, I mean, even if it's only, like, 20 light years or like, 50 light years, then it's still going to take 20 years for them to get whatever signal we decide to send back to them, or 1,000 years, or however far away we are. So that's a lot of time for people to lose interest and sort of forget, and you can't really follow up on a sign like that in any kind of reasonable way, at least not in anybody's lifetime.
Well, the mother.
So I don't know, I think...
Keep in mind, the mothership may just be hovering on the other side of the moon waiting to prance
true,
on
true.
Us.
If they're super advanced and they're able to achieve interstellar travel, then they could probably hide themselves from us pretty well. It's really, I think about that a lot. It's really, really interesting to think about. And I mean, I think sci-fi has primed us to believe in the existence of alien life, and I think that the discoveries that we've been talking about in the last hour or so have primed us to believe that. And so I don't think it would be as, like, shocking as a lot of people might think, just because it's already been kind of internalized in the public consciousness. But if it's intelligent, then I think, yes, and I think that's going to be the biggest deal, and it will cause a lot of soul-searching. But then again, I also think, just based on the distances and the lack of ability to follow up or do much about it within anybody's lifetime, people may stop caring, which is pretty depressing. But that might take, like, 2 years or 5 years, but... They'll start worrying about the price of gas more, and things will go back to the sort of baseline level where they've been before.
Are you at all watching this new science fiction show on Fox Network called Orville?
No, I actually haven't seen it. No.
So it's
McFarlane's show, right?
Yeah, it's Seth MacFarlane, and it's kind of a parody spoof on the Star Trek series. But the one last night, and I'm watching it, and don't ask me why. So, the captain and the first officer are taking a shuttlecraft to go check something out, and they've been spoofed, and they are captured by this advanced species who puts them in a people zoo for different other species that they collect around the solar system and the galaxy. And they replicated their New York City apartment and the New York skyline, and they have a glass window and a force field so they can't get out. And the people on their planet come and stare at them as residents of the zoo like we do, and you go to the San Francisco Zoo and you want to look at the lions or the elephants or something like that. So I guess there is that possibility that advanced civilization is out there, and, you know, people say that's why you don't want to do active SETI, because they may not be so nice. But so this second showing of Orville, that was the number two, the second one in their series, was about capturing the captain and the first officer and putting them in a zoo on display by a more advanced civilization than we humans. But there were other civilizations in the zoo too. So it was kind of a comedic take on that. So what do you do if you really do make contact with an advanced civilization. How do you know they're nice guys or not so nice guys? In fact, David Brin spoke a little bit about that at his talk at the Starship Congress, as I recall.
Yeah, and that's one of the possible explanations for the Fermi paradox.
Right.
Most of the listeners probably know what that is. You know, if like given how big the galaxy is, I mean, like 200 billion stars or thereabouts, and like how many of the planets are potentially habitable. It seems like if there is intelligent life, which seems like there should be, if it can evolve in any kind of reasonably timely fashion, then we should have already come across some signs of it. So that's one explanation. So yeah, the Fermi paradox is, well, if that's true, then why haven't we? And there are all these hypotheses, and like one of them is the zoo hypothesis, that they are like, that these intelligent aliens already know about us, that they're sort of keeping us in the equivalent of a zoo and just watching us and studying us from afar, and they're so advanced that we can't even tell that they're there. They take some kind of interest in us. It strikes me as a little bit, human-centered that they would care so much about us that they want to study us and watch us and protect us. But that's like one of the possible explanations people have offered. Dozens and dozens of them. Pretty interesting to actually read, read through them.
We want to capture and study and look at hippopotami, so... why not some civilization wanting to stare and look at us? But according to Mr. Musk, we may all be in a computer simulation zoo. So, that he is one of the many that talks about that seriously. So, who knows? If that's true, getting out of Earth's gravity you might not still get out of the computer simulation. So that's a whole different way to look at things.
If the aliens are sufficiently advanced, then theoretically they could have simulated the entire galaxy or the entire universe. Who knows?
Let me see if I can set the stage for this question, because most of our listeners were not at the Starship Congress, but listeners, they had a theme that I'm going to ask Mike about in just a minute that was spaces for everybody. And my take on what they mean by that is that there should be no limitations or no restrictions for anybody for any reason, even if they have a mental or physical or mental handicap, if they want to go to space, spaces for them. And so there should be no impediments for them to go to space if they want to go to space. And in fact, they had one of the technical speakers was a young lady who did have some kind of a learning or speaking or some kind of an issue, but she delivered a paper on different parts of astronomy and stuff that was actually pretty interesting. And I forget her name, but you can see that talk and hear her at the Starship Congress events. I sort of took issue in the panel discussion on what I thought was their definition of space is for everybody, because I don't really believe that space is for everybody. Meaning, if you want to go to space, you get to go, and there should be no impediments, because I don't believe that. But I do believe that the benefits for going to space are for everybody and should not be taken away from different cultures, different nations, different people. And so if you find cures, if you find better ways of doing things, absolutely the science, all of the genetics, everything should filter through to people all over the world, and that would include people in really horrible countries with totalitarian governments and crappy leadership like North Korea and Iran and other places. They should be able to benefit from space. So that was my take on spaces for everybody, which was not the same as theirs, I think. What is your take on spaces for everybody?
Yeah, like I took it more to mean they want to get it out into the public consciousness that just like as a way for everybody to think about space and to internalize space as part of their daily lives or something that could be achieved in the future. I don't agree that like absolutely everybody should go to space either. It's just, I mean, or will go to space. That's just not going to happen. But I think that the thrust of what they meant, this my interpretation, was that if you get it into people's heads that absolutely anybody can go and absolutely anybody can be an astronaut, and there are people, you know, there are people going to schools and teaching kids in third world countries and in developed communities that they could be an astronaut too if they work hard and if they do math and science and really put their minds to it. And that's sort of what I think. It's an effort to get it across that space is not just this far off dream for like fighter pilots who join NASA. It's like we want the public to sort of think about space a little differently than they have for the last 50 years. Like we want them to think that absolutely anybody could go if they really wanted to and if they put their minds to it and if they like work hard enough. So that was just sort of my interpretation. I thought it was sort of like a metaphor more than an actual goal to send everybody into space or to encourage everybody that they should go to space, but just to like let everybody, I mean, especially kids, know that it's something that we can do if we want to, and that'll help maybe like affect a shift in the way we think about space and make it feel less far off and less difficult and more achievable in lots of different ways.
Okay, and you have another question from Andrea. Maybe it's Andrea, and she's in New York City. And she says, we constantly read different kinds of articles and different news articles from various journalists about crews going to Mars, maybe a one-way Mars trip, or maybe even going to the moon to do a settlement on the moon. There is even some things that I read about doing orbital space stations for orbital space colonies rather than going to the surface of the moon or onto Mars. And they talk about crew mix. Not only do they talk about the gender mix, which is a big topic, but they also talk about the kinds of people and the skill sets that may be needed to start a space settlement or a space colony. One of the professions I don't see ever talked about is having journalists on board these early space settlement efforts. I'd like to know your thoughts about that. Do you think it would be important to have a journalist on board an early space settlement to write up news reports, public relations stories, tell it like it is, and get it back to people on Earth, maybe to help drive new people wanting to go to space, or maybe to warn them if there are perils we don't know about? What do you think the role of journalists might be for space settlement?
That's a really interesting question. I actually haven't really thought about it all that much. I mean, in those terms, about actually having a professional journalist on board, because, I mean, I think it'll be really important that the trip is chronicled in a very thorough way. Right? I mean, you're going to want to have video of pretty much everything important that's happening. You're going to want crew members to write very frequent sort of blog posts, updates, what they find. You're going to want that all to be public, and hopefully anyway, or at least most of the stuff that can be public, as opposed to have it sent to some government space agency and only get parceled out bit by bit. It'll be really interesting if a journalist could go and wanted to go. I think that would be great. I think it would be really great to have kind of like really frequent kind of dispatches told about the crew's experience and what the situation's like and what's needed to make this work. If that's not in the offing, if no professional journalist wants to go, though, then I think that the crew members can fulfill that role. And I think that should be a part of their mission. Is getting the message out and doing the public outreach. I think they would have to write like really frequent like kind of log entries and like getting those out. I mean, video and print and lots of images. That would be a huge part of like any mission. I mean, especially in the early days. And I think it should be clear from the outset that will be a big part of the crew members' missions. I mean, whoever ends up going, they will have to chronicle it in a very detailed way and get it out to the world, basically.
Are you interested in going?
To Mars? Or to the moon?
Or to any kind of space settlement. Would you be wanting to go?
I would love to go. I wouldn't want to go one way. I've got a young kid. I don't want to be away from him for very long. I don't want to do a one-way trip to Mars. And I probably wouldn't want to do a like round trip until I get a bit older and get to watch my son grow up. And it'd be pretty scary to get on the first few flights and not know what you're getting into and not knowing if you're going to survive and all that. I don't know if I have the stomach to be one of those first pioneers. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. All these other people who are a lot braver than me. But if in like 30 or 40 years, everything's proven out pretty well, and I think it'd be awesome to go to Mars and stay there for a year and then come back. I'd be up for that.
But to come back, not to be a one-way settler.
I don't think I want to be a one-way settler. No, I don't know. I don't think I'd want to be away from everybody, like in my life, kind of forever. I mean, I think that's a bit much. I mean, other people will feel differently and would be more willing to do it, but I don't think it's for me.
So even like a low Earth orbit space station, like Al Globus talks about frequently, where you could easily get back to Earth, that wouldn't do it on a permanent basis for you either, huh?
I don't know if I want to be in orbit permanently. I don't know. It'd have to be a pretty big space station for me to want to stay there for the rest of my life. I would love to go to space. Yeah, I would love to go to the ISS if they're still doing tourist trips and I had $30 million to spend. I would love to do something like that. I'd love to go to the moon for a while and come back. But yeah, if I'm going to live in space, I would want to have a fair bit of room to kind of run around, and I would want to be trapped in a tiny habitat for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I'd probably get claustrophobic. I wouldn't like to do it too. In the a couple of minutes left of the show, and listeners, if you do want to call us, our line is available, and there is still time to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223, and email is drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. So let's talk a little bit about timelines and how you see things happening, given that you follow events closely and all the time. Do you see space settlement? Well, let's start with Mars first. No, let's start with the moon first. Humans returning to the moon. When do you see that as likely to happen?
I think there will be enough of a push. I think China really wants to do it. And the private sector really wants to do it. I think in the next 10 to 15 years, there'll probably be somebody setting foot on the moon again. I don't know. I mean, part of me wants to say earlier than that, but things always take longer than you think they will. So maybe in the late 2020s, I would bet there'll be footprints on the moon again.
Late 2020, that's 10 years from now.
Yeah, 10 to 15. I'd say 10 to 15 years. So something around that. Maybe around 2030.
I thought we would do Mars by 2030, so humans to Mars. Where are you seeing that happen?
Maybe not too long after that. I mean, if SpaceX continues to advance, I mean, we're going to get another look at the updated architecture that they're planning to use for their Mars trips in a week or so. At a conference in Australia, Elon Musk is going to present the latest architecture. If they keep advancing, then yeah, maybe the first mission would blast off around that same time or a little later. I don't know. That's going to be very difficult. I mean, like NASA is targeting kind of mid to late 2030s. But it's always so hard to tell because it depends, like everything is tied to the, which way the politics are going and who, like what the administration prioritizes. And so, and that's not NASA's fault. That's just how it works being government space agency. You can't predict things all that far out. But I would think maybe that the SpaceX and NASA kind of efforts might be happening along similar sorts of timelines, so like mid to late 2030s people. I would be tempted to say earlier, but it's such a difficult thing to do. Things always take a little longer than we want them to.
So here's the real one. If something like Breakthrough Starshot becomes plausible, when would you see us being able to launch microchip arrays at 20 to 30% the speed of light to Proxima B? Is that 100 years from now, maybe 50 years from now? I know that their goal is to get the cost way, way down for the giant kind of 50-gigawatt lasers that they need. That's a big issue. Although the cost of lasers is coming down, but let's give it the assumption that it is plausible to do this. Microchip propellant at 20 to 30% the speed of light. 50 years, 100 years?
I would hope it's sooner than that. I mean, they said that if everything goes perfectly, then maybe the first test launches or the first launches of any sort could be 20, 25 years. And a full-on 20% speed of light targeted launch to Proxima Centauri, Alpha Centauri, would probably happen after that. But I don't know. If everything goes well and if the technology is actually as kind of viable as they think it is, I mean, it could be maybe... 30 years or something, we could launch our first interstellar probe, maybe even a little sooner than that.
So sometime around maybe 2050, give or take.
2040 to 2050, maybe, yeah. I mean, 2045-ish, about the time of the singularity, when, like Ray Kurzweil said, we're all going to become machines.
Do you think if we are able to propel anything at 20 or 25% the speed of light, that'll be a big shock with our culture, or we'll just take it in stride and not pay a whole lot of attention to it?
I don't think it'll shock people. I think it'll be amazing. And, human spaceflight tends to get the most bang out of people. I mean, like truly achieving interstellar flight, I think that's an interesting question, because actually achieving that level of speed, I think, I don't think the public will appreciate it to the extent that they should. Like the first ever relativistic flight that we've accomplished would be awesome. But if the probe did manage to get to the Alpha Centauri system and say get photos of Proxima Centauri B, which is the planet there that, like around Proxima, and those pictures come home, and we have a picture of an exoplanet taken from an exoplanet flyby, you know, that would probably be the like galvanizing moment. Like if everything goes well, I think that would be the moment where people really sit back and say, wow, what we did was just truly amazing. And I mean, I'm not saying that that's right, because I think actually getting the probe up to that velocity should be heralded as an amazing accomplishment, but just kind of like human nature might not appreciate that to the extent that it should. And all this being said, I mean, I'll the timeline stuff, I'm kind of being pessimistic, and I certainly hope that I'm wrong about a lot of stuff, especially in Mars. But part of it's just, I kind of want to be pleasantly surprised, and I don't want to get my hopes up too much. So I certainly hope people land on the moon before the late 2020s, and I certainly hope SpaceX is able to get people to Mars before the mid 2030s. But, I'm just trying to be a bit pessimistic, and so I don't get too disappointed if things don't happen on a quick timeline.
As we're getting close to the end of our program, it's clear that you are a big vision guy, yet you have to report on what is clearly the mundane if you compare it to some of these big vision topics. Is that hard for you to do? Do you find that challenging and keeping your interest?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't. It's true that there are stories that you write and you're like, I'm not super interested in that, but you don't ever want to feel like it's mundane because, like you want to recognize that. I mean, like I wrote a story today just about about some of the pictures that, like NASA's Juno spacecraft took of like Jupiter on its last flyby of Jupiter. And it's done 8 of these flybys now since it got into orbit last summer. And every time the pictures that come back are just amazing. And so even writing a little story like that, like, wow, look at these awesome pictures that we have of Jupiter, it's kind of mundane, but then again, it's actually really not. It's still like these fabulous pictures of the biggest planet in the solar system that, I mean, we've never seen anything like these images, even though we've had probes of Jupiter before. Like, these are just amazing. And you can't really let yourself, or if you find yourself really feeling that it's mundane, then you need to kind of reassess where you are, where your head is. And, like, even some of these littler stories, you write about a satellite launch, and it's not the most exciting thing in the world, but it's still a rocket launch. It's still a satellite in space. So just always, like, remind yourself, like, that is really cool, even though it's just another communication satellite. You know, there is a rocket that succeeded in putting a satellite into orbit right in the right spot. And that's just, it's really cool. There's really cool pictures of the launch. Like, it's not really all that mundane, if you really think about it. It's really fun to write the big picture stuff about when do we think we're going to discover alien life, or when could interstellar flight be a reality. But you also think that every one of these kind of smaller stories that you write is a step along that path. Talking about the steps that humanity and scientists and engineers are taking along that path, and also, in some small way, if people read these stories, then they'll be more interested in space, and, I mean, like, all of us working together, I mean, like, talking about these cool things that we're doing in space can hopefully, I mean, gin up even more interest, and that interest gets to Congress and the President, and, I mean, I'm not trying to say that that's my ultimate goal with every story that I write, but it's all part of this bigger picture, right, where people who care about these things, like, we can do little things, and hopefully it kind of adds up over time, and we can all see this really amazing future that we want to see.
It is going to be amazing. It just seems like it's unfolding in many ways a little bit too slow, but...
That's always been true, right? Everybody, I mean, after we like landed the man on the moon, I mean, if you ask somebody in 1972 what our space program would be like in 2017, they'd probably have said we've been to Mars and we had colonies on the moon and all the rest of it. So things don't work out as fast as you want them to.
In terms of thinking about the listeners to this show and the people who follow space and are really interested in it and or even working in it in some form or another, any particular closing comments or perspectives that you would direct to that specific targeted audience?
No, I don't think so. Kind of going along what I was just kind of rambling about, just that the stuff is really neat, and don't sort of let yourself get jaded about even the small things that we're doing, because the small things are still really amazing. I mean, we talked about Planet, and like you mentioned that they were able to get really good images of that North Korean missile test. And so yeah, there's lots of amazing things going on, and we can get distracted and we can allow ourselves to lose interest. But, you know, space is just, it's got this cachet, I think, that you can't, like, lose sight of. It's just really cool. It's really exciting stuff, and you can't let the kind of drumbeat of things happening every day kind of dull you to how cool this stuff really is.
Too easy to take it all for granted, isn't it? It looks too easy and too routine now.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and it's sort of like that kind of came home. I mean, I'm really going to miss Cassini. We talked about that, you know, on Friday. Like, as of Friday, Cassini is no more. And it's one of those things, it's like my daily drum beats. I'm going to miss the daily drum beats of Cassini photos. And that was one of the markers that kind of, like, hit home about, it kind of rammed home how amazing what we're doing as a species really is. You know, these pictures of Saturn moons and amazing sunlit views of Saturn and its rings. And you see those every day, you know, and it's not hard to lose sight of, like, how remarkable these achievements are when you get, a new photo of Enceladus or of Titan's lakes and all that. And, and now it's just, now that Cassini is gone, I'm not trying to say it's, like, all about Cassini or it's just where it shouldn't have been disposed of, because it needed to be. It was almost out of fuel. NASA made a really informed decision. But it's just, it's kind of fresh in my mind. I'm just going to really miss Cassini and all those images that it provided and all the amazing science. That was just in my head because it's just so recent. And that's another, it was a mission that really reminded us every day of how amazing this stuff really is.
You got one 11th hour email that just came in from Linda in Phoenix. And listeners, this will be the last question. And Linda says, given the conversation you're having now as you're winding down the show, I'm wondering if you have to pay special attention when you write or work with an article or a subject to stay fresh and to convey excitement and passion to your readers, because if you take it somewhat mundane, that's probably what you project to the readers, and that's not what you want to do. So do you have to make a special effort to not take things for granted when you write and research your articles?
That's a really good question. And yeah, there are some stories where you do need to make more of an effort than others. Some things that like the things that I choose to actually write about, those are the things I find really interesting and really exciting, and I don't have to think about why is this interesting or why is this cool. And there are some that you do have to think about how should I frame this and what's the most exciting part of this. And yeah, that's a really good point. There are some that are more exciting than others. And when you're writing a story about something that's not the most exciting thing to you personally but still is important, then you do need to think about what's the coolest thing about this and how can I not just go through the motions and how can I that convey to myself and to the reader that this is really cool. And yes, there are some where you do need to think about that more than with others. That's a very good point.
And people can read your work in space.com, right?
Yep.
And do you publish in other sources too?
Well, we're syndicated pretty widely in our stuff. I mean, like we get published in the Scientific American and get syndicated on, like Gets to Space News and like a few others. I think NBC News might be a partner as well. So they sort of get out there. It's not just on space.com. We have a bunch of kind of media partners that the stories get out to.
So people can find you in a lot of different quality space publications. That would be a good way of saying it.
Sure. Yeah.
And listeners, check him out and check out his stories. You can also do a Google or Bing for his name, and you will find lots and lots and lots of his articles. Do you have a website where you post your articles or upload them?
No, they're just all on space.com, and if you just search for me on space.com, that'd probably be the best way to do it.
Okay. We certainly appreciate your writing and the work that you do, and I do, and I'm really glad we finally got to do this show. I've been wanting to do it with you for quite a few years. And I will look forward to talking with you again down the road. And I look forward to that and hope you do too as well. And I again apologize for the delays and starting off late with a little bit of a technical problem.
No, it's totally fine. I'm really happy to to come on. And, yeah, I mean, I appreciate the chance to talk to you. And anytime you want to do it again, let me know.
Will do. And listeners, that's it. So please do remember, there's no show tomorrow due to dental surgery, and no show planned for Hotel Mars on Wednesday or Friday due to my possible stint at being a juror in jury duty. Back again on Sunday with open lines, and Monday is a big question mark based on what happens with jury duty. Everybody have a great week. Please keep looking up. Keep it safe. And thank you for listening. Thanks to Mike for being with us, and to all of you as well. Goodbye from Mike Wall. Goodbye from David and the Space Show.